Hallo und herzlich willkommen zur zweiten Folge von US-Wahlgelaber mit Markus und Max. Heute werden wir kurz über die Medienlandschaft in den USA reden und dann die langjährige amerikanische Journalistin Beth Dufresne zur Rolle der Medien in dieser Wahl fragen. Wenn ihr euch jetzt schon langweilt, schreibt es uns auf unserer Website uswahl.com in die Kommentare rein und dann lasst es den Podcast einfach laufen, bis Frau Dufresne spricht. Das Interview ist nämlich wirklich spannend. Und natürlich, schämt euch. Wir sind super spannend und ja, so viel von meiner Seite zur Hörerinnenbeleidigung.
Ja, keine Manier. Keine Manier, der Max. Es gibt uns übrigens auch auf Spotify. Ihr könnt uns also gerne zweimal hören und natürlich folgt uns und teilt den Podcast. Das hilft uns sehr. So, damit jetzt zu unserem heutigen Thema. Es ist keine Woche mehr bis zur Wahl. In den Medien wird der Wahlkampf rauf und runter gespielt und auch wir labern darüber. Aber wer labert so in den USA? Die Vereinigten Staaten haben das einflussreichste Mediensystem der Welt, das kann man sicher so sagen. Das stimmt natürlich für die Unterhaltung, Stichwort Hollywood, aber auch für journalistische Medien. Ja, und diese journalistischen Medien schauen wir uns heute an. Die sind nämlich ziemlich divers. Viele Gemeinden und Regionen haben ihre eigenen Zeitungen, Radio und sogar Fernsehsender. Dazu kommen Medien auf Staatsebene und natürlich die Nationalmedien, die wir alle kennen. Oder kennen sollten. Also im Print etwa die Washington Post und die New York Times oder die Nachrichtensender Fox News und CNN.
Ja, und da sind wir dann eh schon gleich bei ein paar Dingen, die das amerikanische Mediensystem so vom europäischen unterscheiden. Und den ersten Punkt hast du ja gerade schon angesprochen. Nämlich, es gibt einfach sehr, sehr viele Regionalmedien. Also wirklich auf unterster Ebene, eben auf Stadtebene, auf Gemeindeebene. Und die sind teils selbstständig, also teils ist das halt wirklich der eine Radio-Host oder die eine kleine Station, die das einfach macht, oder die Dorfzeitung sozusagen. Aber teils gehören sie auch zu größeren Unternehmen. Also vor 3 Jahren hat eben etwa John Oliver zur rechten Sinclair-Gruppe einen Beitrag gemacht und dort werden zum Beispiel überregionale Beiträge gestaltet und die regionalen Sender müssen die dann senden. Und für die Zuseher ist das natürlich nicht immer transparent. Das heißt, dieses regionale Mediensystem hat dahingehend auch teilweise seine Nachteile. Und da kommen wir dann auch gleich zum zweiten Punkt, nämlich die USA haben eine recht polarisierte Medienlandschaft. Das heißt, auf der einen Seite, ja, ich habe jetzt schon von einem rechten Medium gesprochen, das ist in den USA noch leichter zu erkennen als bei uns, weil viele Medien deklarieren bei Wahlen auch, wen sie unterstützen, meistens einen von den zwei Kandidaten. Die USA sind ja ein Zwei-Parteien-System, also meistens gibt es einen Republikaner oder einen Demokraten oder eine Republikanerin oder eine Demokratin, als zweiteres öfter als das erstere. Und das heißt dann zum Beispiel, dass die städtische Zeitung halt den Bürgermeisterkandidaten empfiehlt, also sagt, wir vertrauen diesem Kandidaten, wir vertrauen dieser Kandidatin nicht. Und dann aber auch auf überregionale Ebene geht. Also dass zum Beispiel, ja, weiß nicht, eine Lokalzeitschrift dann sagt, welchen Kandidaten für die Präsidentschaftswahl sie unterstützen würde. Und bei den meisten Medien kann man sich das eh denken. Etwa wird der linke Sender MSNBC eher keinen Republikaner unterstützen und der rechte Sender Fox sicher keinen Demokraten.
Ja, und das spiegelt sich natürlich auch in der Berichterstattung wider. Also da ein öffentlich-rechtlicher Sender wie der ORF zum Beispiel bei uns fehlt, haben die...
Oder für unsere deutschen Zuhörer ZDF, ARD,
Ja,
Arte.
und für unsere britischen Zuschauer BBC.
Haben jetzt beide Zuschauer gesagt schon, ne? Okay.
Aber
Schaut
ja,
uns
also
zu.
da der halt fehlt, haben die Amerikaner ein anderes Verhältnis zu den Medien. In Europa haben die Medien auch einen Vertrauensverlust erlitten, aber die Menschen vertrauen öffentlich-rechtlichen Sendern nach wie vor um einiges mehr als privat-kommerziellen Sendern. Die gibt es aber, wie gesagt, also diese öffentlich-rechtlichen Sender gibt es aber in den USA eben nicht. Und die Medien verfolgen manchmal mehr, manchmal weniger offensichtlich eine politische Agenda, die mit dem Objektivitätsgebot von einem ORF zum Beispiel nicht vereinbar ist. Dementsprechend niedrig ist das Vertrauen der amerikanischen Bevölkerung in die Medien. Und da sind die Republikaner viel misstrauischer als die Demokraten. Es sagen zum Beispiel nur 14% der Republikaner, dass die Medien eine objektive Berichterstattung bieten. Bei den Demokraten sind es immerhin 46%. Ich glaube, die Diskrepanz dazwischen kann man, die gibt es aus vielerlei Gründen, aber Herr Trump hat da natürlich auch eine große Rolle gespielt, nachdem er im Grunde jedes Medium, abgesehen von Fox News, als Fake News beschimpft hat. Ja, also von dieser Warte her kommt diese Ablehnung der Medien gegenüber auch nicht von ungefähr.
Ja, was, sagen wir mal, ob das jetzt geschadet hat, hätte ich mir vielleicht besser überlegen sollen, bevor ich da jetzt angefangen habe zu reden, aber zumindest ein Punkt, wo man das sehr stark sieht, diese Polarisierung und auch jetzt mittlerweile dieses Misstrauen, sind die Panels, die in den USA sehr beliebt sind, also in den großen Medien, in den großen Sendern, vor allem in denen, die sich mit Objektivität rühmen, wie zum Beispiel CNN. Diese Panels sind einfach im Endeffekt Diskussionsrunden, wo zu einem bestimmten Thema einfach Gäste geladen werden, und oft sind sie so gewählt, dass eben die Gäste unterschiedliche Positionen vertreten. Das heißt, auf der einen Seite steht zum Beispiel ein Republikaner, auf der anderen Seite ein Demokrat. Es gibt aber auch Situationen, wenn jetzt zum Beispiel über die Zukunft der Republikanischen Partei gesprochen wird, dass ein moderater Republikaner gegen einen rechteren Republikaner gematcht wird, sozusagen. Spätestens unter Trump wurde dieses Konzept aber komplett zerstört oft, weil eine Seite einfach nicht mehr an einem ehrlichen Diskurs interessiert war und, ich sag's mal nett, auch der Wahrheit eher seltener nahe steht. Und das endet dann eben oft einfach in so Schreiduellen, wie wir es bei der ersten Debatte zwischen Biden und Trump erlebt haben. Ja, und dazwischen sitzen dann eben die Zuseher und die schalten dann weg. Die schalten dann auf Fox zum Beispiel, wo sich alle einig sind, dass Sozialleistungen die böseste kommunistische Erfindung aller Zeiten sind und nur Trump Weihnachten retten kann. Also ja, ich drücke mich so aus, deutlich gewählter hat sich unsere Expertin diese Folge ausgedrückt. Sie ist 35 Jahre lang Journalistin, hat also eine Menge Erfahrung in ihrem Job und vor allem, sie ist Amerikanerin und spricht kein Deutsch. Also, Ohren und Google Translate aufmachen für unser erstes englischsprachiges Interview und für Beth DeFries.
Okay, then maybe would you like to just quickly introduce yourself so that our readers...
Sure. My name is Beth Dufresne. I live in Connecticut. I have been a journalist for about 35 years. For many years, I was a columnist and a feature writer and an editor at a daily newspaper in Connecticut called The Day. I follow politics closely. I don't consider myself an expert, but I certainly follow it very closely, both in the print and on television.
The first question I would have is, in 2008, after the election of Barack Obama, there seemed to be a spirit of optimism all over the United States. And, you know, there were talks about racial injustice being a thing of the past. And everyone was looking very, yeah, very optimistically into the future.
There was hope.
Yeah, there was hope, like he put it. And eight years later, Donald Trump gets elected as president of the United States. What do you think happened in those 8 years that all that optimism and all that hope for the future has like almost vanished?
Well, several things. First of all, the expectations, I think, for Barack Obama, and I supported him, by the way, and still do, as a person, as a president, the expectations were very, very large, almost so large that it would be hard for anyone to live up to them. It was rather naive of us Americans to think that just because we had an African-American president, that all of a sudden, all these problems of racism, which are very much a part of our history, would go away. So I think the optimism was probably just a little bit too far reaching. Now, the other thing is that at least at the beginning, Barack Obama, who is he's a person that wants to bring people together, wanted to work with Republicans, bring the whole country together. The Republicans did not respond to that. He found himself working with a Republican Party that simply their goal was to block anything he wanted to do. So that he was not able to accomplish a lot of the things that he had hoped. So we're now at a point Donald Trump, yes. Where did Donald Trump come from? A lot of us have been asking ourselves that question over and over again. I've been asking it. First of all, it's important to remember Donald Trump did not win the popular vote. He won through the Electoral College. In a way, it was almost a kind of fluke. If you look at the states that he won, he might have totally won, you know, in the United States by about 80,000 votes. So it's not like he came in on a landslide. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It's safe to say that the majority of the American people did not want Donald Trump as president when he won. And safe to say that they don't want him now. There is a long stemming, and I'm sure you're aware of this, racism in the United States. We all realize that. And perhaps, you know, even having an African-American president brought out some resentments, you know, that people had long felt. I can't say for sure what happened. I go back again to the fact that, you know, the majority of the American people did not choose Donald Trump. he won because of our electoral system. And there is a big push right now to get rid of the Electoral College and have the president decided by the popular vote, which I certainly hope will happen.
Do you think that's realistic?
I think it's not realistic right now, certainly, but in the future, I think it's realistic. It's possible. I'm hoping that Joe Biden will be elected. I'm hoping that he will be a bridge towards a time. He's not as alienating as Hillary Clinton was. He's easier to like. He may be able to divides, you know, with Republicans and get more people behind him. And who knows? And I mean, anything can happen. But the one positive thing about what's going on now, I mean, as disturbing as all of these racial animosities and difficulties are coming to the surface, at least they are coming to the surface, perhaps in a way that they haven't before. And I do think the majority of Americans want to deal with it. I really do. I think the majority of Americans are very disturbed by Donald Trump's encouragement and certainly lack of disencouragement to the racist elements in the United States. I'm hopeful. My biggest fear right now, and people like me, our biggest fear, is that because we still have this Electoral College and the majority vote, you know, isn't necessarily what's going to decide who our president is, that Donald Trump could squeak by somehow and win another term. Then I think we've got real problems. I think that if Joe Biden wins, I think we'll be okay here in the United States. There are concerns, obviously, that some of these, you know, militia groups, you know, might turn violent. But I think the majority of the country doesn't want that. And so I think we would probably be able to ride that out. My real fear is that he would somehow squeak by through the Electoral College and get another term. Then I think America's in big trouble. And I think the world would be at a loss too, because America's important, I think, to the world.
You just said if Trump would win, it would be a big loss. And if Biden would win, you would like, it would be okay, so to speak. But what would be your hopes for a Biden presidency other than not it being a Trump presidency?
That's a very good question. Now, the Trump presidency is so frightening that Biden just winning would be enough for a lot of us. We would breathe a huge sigh of relief because once again, we could feel like we could make some progress. You know, Biden has become much more progressive in his thinking. He's not as progressive as a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg. He was not my first choice, but he's a good man. And he is interested, I think, in and being a bridge perhaps is something even more progressive. Look at Kamala Harris, look who we chose. You know, she is considered perhaps the most progressive member of Congress, of the Senate. So I think that if Biden wins in terms of a progressive future, a more progressive future for the United States, I think there's a really good possibility. What we'll be dealing with, however, is the detritus of the Trump administration. We still have COVID, which was handled disastrously, if it was handled at all by him. Biden will be having to clean up from that. We still have a massive tax break that was passed by Trump and the Republicans, which most of the benefits go to the very, very upper class, the richest Americans. And that's going to hamstring, you know, a lot of other things happening. So there'll be a big, big job for Biden if he wins. But I think he has the personality, the kindness, the empathy, the experience that he may be able to handle it. And after all, he, unlike Trump feels that he's the only one in charge, he and his family. It's like a family business. Biden understands that the United States of America is not a family business. It's a democratic government, and the president is a leader, but a lot of other people who know what they're doing, who are hired for their expertise, do the work. So I think Biden will bring a lot of other people into the government. All those more progressive people that were running against Biden in the primaries, I think they will play a role. He will give them a role, and that makes me optimistic. That makes me up.
Okay, and then maybe going like looking away from all the policies of Donald Trump, the United States seem to be as polarized as they've never been before. And do you think that's only a result of the last 4 years, or were the U.S. already polarized before Trump became president?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's always going to be polarization. I'm sure there's polarization in your country.
It's not comparable to the U.S. It's certainly not comparable to the U.S. Maybe also because of the two-party system, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. So there's always polarization. And a couple of things to remember. First of all, America, have you been to America, by the way?
Yes.
Have you been to America?
But I've been very young, so.
Yeah. So America is very large with a lot of different cultures. You know, California and Wyoming and Florida and Idaho, they are very different places. The miracle of America, the good part of America, is that we've managed to hold all these essentially little countries, these states, together. And that's what makes, that's the greatness of America. But it's not easy. It's not easy. And we haven't always done a good job. So yes, there will always be polarization. I do think certainly that it's worse now, certainly than it ever has been in my lifetime. It's definitely worse. But the main reason that it's worse, frankly, is Donald Trump. You know, he has governed by polarization. That's his method. He has spent his entire 4 years encouraging that polarization. That's how he always conducted business. That was his persona as a reality TV star. So it really starts with him. And because he also had a Republican Party, you know about the Tea Party, you know, the much more conservative Republican Party, that has changed very much from the Republican Party of, say, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It's kind of all about winning. And, you know, Trump's the president. They want these tax cuts. The Republican Party has not made any effort to reach across the aisle. We had during Barack Obama's term, I mean, Mitch McConnell, you know, the leader of the Senate, stood with a rifle over his head and said the main purpose of his party was to make sure Barack Obama didn't get reelected. I mean, that was a horrible thing to say and do. So we have a Republican Party, today's Republican Party, it hasn't always been this way, and a president who have made polarization their policy. So yes, it is worse than it's ever been. But if you look at the majority of the American people, I still feel that this is not what the majority wants. The majority, may not be more polarized, you know, than they have ever been. I have a neighbor actually who's a Trump supporter, yes. And when we sit down and talk about specific things, specific items, we're not that far apart. it's the leadership right now that is the real problem. It's Trump and it's the Republican Party.
Why do you think is your neighbor a Trump supporter? What does he like about him?
One of the big problems, and as a journalist, this is something that concerns me deeply, and my husband as well, who's a retired journalism professor. Fox News, have you yes. watched it? Are you aware of that? If Fox News was a legitimate conservative news station, with a conservative, that would be fine. We need a conservative point of view, just like we need the progressive point of view. I'm a liberal progressive, but I recognize that, you know, I appreciate a good conservative view. Fox News has become simply a mouthpiece for Trump and the Republican Party. I don't consider it a legitimate news organization. And unfortunately, a lot of people, and here's where my neighbor comes in, this is what they watch. And they are being fed, in many instances, outright lies. There are some legitimate journalists during the daytime, particularly, not their commentators at night on Fox. Most of the better ones have left. but this is a real problem. A lot of people are simply, it used to be, see, I was mostly a print journalist, you know, during my career. And it used to be that, you know, every town, you know, cities, we all had our own newspapers. And people were getting all kinds of different points of view. Now you can just tune into Fox and you never hear another point of view. You know, plus they're deliberately creating a scenario that is simply not true. You know, I for instance, have looked at some Fox coverage, say, of protests by the Black Lives Matter movement. There will be a massive protest. It will be 99% peaceful, okay? People being very polite, out there, you know, with their kids and, you know, doing the right thing. This is what you'll see, you know, on CNN or MSNBC. You turn to Fox. If there is one person in that crowd, particularly, and they'll focus on a Black person, you know, who is maybe particularly, I don't know, you know, mouthing off or, you know, whatever, not behaving properly, they will focus on that person and keep focusing on that person and keep running that that news coverage over and over again to give the impression that everyone is like that person, when in fact the majority are nothing like that person. So that's the problem. People are not getting they're not getting the news. They're not getting the truth.
But you would not see any problem with the media system in the U.S. in general. For example, what I often hear is that CNN, for example, doing these panels of one side, the other side, and then having a Democrat and a Republican, or even a moderate Republican and a very conservative Republican or a Trump Republican against each other, that these panels give the impression of both sides being equal, even if one side lies and the other side speaks the truth. Isn't that a problem even outside of Fox News as well?
Absolutely. And you know, I can tell that you're very well informed because this is a major problem, you know, and you already know that, you know, absolutely. But I think there's been a change. This has been a real wake-up call these last 4 years, a real wake-up call for the American people and also for the news media. Because that balancing, when it's not, there really isn't any balance, as you said, one is just simply not true. Or one might be the opinion of 10 people and the other is the opinion of, you know, 30 million people or something. Or one is the opinion of somebody who doesn't know anything and the other is the opinion of an expert. No, they're not all equal. And I think that, I think journalists have really woken up to that, you know, and I think they're doing better. They're doing much better. The other thing, looking back 4 years ago, when I think about the news media responding to Donald Trump, you know, the lies. this has been, it still astounds so many of us that this person in his position, the president of the United States, could be a pathological liar, a serial liar. And it took a long time for the media to really absorb that. You know, we were trying to say, well, he misspoke or he must have been misinformed or whatever, you know. And finally people, you know, had to wake up, journalists had to wake up and say, whoa, this man is lying, you know, and just tell it like it is. But we weren't prepared for this. We weren't used to this. You know, politicians always, you know, stretch the truth a little or make themselves look better. I mean, that's part of politics. You know, sometimes they say something that's wrong, they have to correct it. I mean, that's politics. But we had never before experienced this degree of lying. And the news media really had to get their heads around it and learn how to deal with it and to call it out for what it is. I think they're much better now.
If you could take like one example of where the news media did change the tone compared to the last election cycle?
Well, you know, I don't know if I can think of a specific example. Well, okay, there is a specific example. Actually, this past Sunday night, Leslie Stahl from the 60 Minutes, she was interviewing Donald Trump. I don't know if you saw it, but he walked out of the interview because she was asking him tough questions. I mean, he can't take tough questions. And he said several things and she just said right back to him, no, that's not true. So that's a perfect example. And I don't think you would have seen that 4 years ago. You would have seen the interviewer go, what do I do here? This is the president of the United States. I can't call him a liar. I can't say no. They would have sooner or later reported, yes, that it was not true. But they wouldn't have thought to challenge the person right flat out. But she did it. She did it. And I think you've seen other newspaper journalists television, any kind of journalists do it. You're seeing them do it. What's happened, though, is that Trump, look, he walked out on Leslie Stahl. He walked out on her. And normally the interviews that he gives are only to people that he knows won't ask those questions and won't call him out. Yeah. So, but no, the news media is much better.
Yeah, it seems that most of the news coverage in the last few years has revolved around Trump's tweets. And it made, let's say, that the focus of the media coverage has been like so strongly or so firmly on Trump himself. That he has been overshadowing all of American politics, basically. Has the news changed their method in that regard?
Well, let me say, I think that the news media has been less successful on that point than on calling him, you know, for his lies. I think they've been less successful on that. My husband, who was a professor for 20 some years at the University of Connecticut, actually had what I thought was a great idea several years ago. He thought that the newspapers ought to run Trump's tweets sort of like the police logs, just run them, you know, don't even comment on them, just run them down. He's the president of the United States. You have to report what he says, but don't pay a whole lot of attention to it because a lot of them aren't true. They'll change tomorrow, and so forth. I think that would have been a good idea, but unfortunately, they didn't do that. Trump has been a master at sucking up all the air in the room, you know, the air in the country. I think that the media has not been as successful on that turn. They've tried. There hasn't been, I think when I look at the news stations, for example, CNN, MSNBC, I often think there should have been a lot more coverage, for instance, on what's happening with environmental regulations, because, you know, he has weakened them to a dangerous point. There are a lot of other things, you know, that we should have been covering, we, the media, should have been covering much more strongly. Trump has still been a master at just getting out there and saying something utterly outrageous that even he doesn't believe, probably, you know, but just to take up all the air in the room. It's all about him.
You already mentioned environmental regulations. And what I ask me is, if you look at the people around you, What are the most important topics in this election for the people themselves, and are they really covered in this news cycle?
But as I look around me, what are the major topics?
Yes, like for example, climate change or healthcare, justice reform. Are there like single topics that you would say, okay, those are topics that really that people really care about, and are they really sufficiently covered by the media?
Yeah. Well, you know, certainly, I mean, the biggest topic for us here, and it has been, I'm sure for you, is this virus. What's that?
I guess it's the same everywhere in the world,
except New Zealand. Yeah, except New Zealand.
And for us, it's not just the virus, but it's been, you know, let me tell you something. I've said to my husband for a long time, this is before the virus, I said, you know, the United States and Trump himself have been fortunate because it was clear how incompetent he was, that he didn't really know how to be the president. But we hadn't had a real major catastrophe in up until this year. We hadn't had a major terrorist attack like 9/11, you know, nothing just of a major crisis that happened. Then it did. Then we had COVID. And that was when I think it was exposed that we had somebody in the White House that simply was not capable of dealing with it. So the United States has been reeling, not just from COVID, but from the fact that we've had an administration that has not been able to deal with it, that hasn't listened to the scientists, that has not modeled proper behavior. And, you know, Americans are used to thinking pretty well of themselves, you know, that we can solve anything and do anything. And we get a little bit too full of ourselves sometimes, but that optimism has an up part of it too, because we're pretty good at banding together, you know, and getting something done. And this year was a real wake-up call because we realized that if you don't have the proper leader in the office and people working with him, you know, who know what they're doing, we mess up. We can't solve it. You know, this is really matters. It really, really matters. And that's why I think you'll see people right now, Americans, you know, out in line to vote, voting early. I think it really has been a wake-up call to America. You know, I mentioned before that Hillary, of course, and you know this, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but, you know, a lot of people just didn't vote the last time when Trump was elected. You know, America doesn't have a very high percentage of people voting who are eligible to vote. This has been a real wake-up call for that. We have realized that the presidency, all of our institutions depend on us taking part. We've gotten too, we were too spoiled. We're too spoiled, you know, laid back. We realized, I think, that we have to work harder. And you asked too, what are the big issues? Well, the big issues are the presidency, are our institutions, our judicial system, our justice system. We have an attorney general right now who's been acting like the president's personal attorney. This is intolerable. We have people being put in positions. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency was an oil lobbyist. I mean, you know, none of this should be happening. A lot of our important institutions, Trump hasn't even put permanent people in there because he likes to just, you know, he's just looking for loyalty and he likes to keep everybody wondering if they're going to have a job tomorrow so that they can kowtow to him. Things have been pretty rough here, I'll tell you. A lot of us are really shell-shocked by what's happened over these years, at least last 4 years. But the good news is that maybe we're going to get out there and make a change.
If you say get out there and make a change and like to get your enthusiasm a bit down again, maybe, because you said before that Obama could not do the things he promised because of a Republican Party who blocked him in the Senate. And even though it might be possible with Republicans such as Lindsey Graham maybe losing their seats in the Senate right now.
I hope.
But probably there still will be a Republican Senate during the Biden administration. So will he really be able to change as much as you wish for?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think there is actually a good chance that there will be a Democratic Senate. I think there's a good chance. I mean, again, nothing is assured. Nothing is assured. Even if not, I think that Biden may have more success. I'm hopeful. I don't know. You know, he might have more success than Barack Obama. I mean, I think racism played a role, you know, with Barack Obama. Let's just say, if Biden does have a Republican Senate and runs into that same kind of, we're not going to let anything get passed, I think Americans are so sick of this, you know, after these past 4 years, there will be much greater pressure, I think, in the next 4 years than there were, you know, previously. I certainly hope so. This is a really crucial time. It's a really crucial time. I mean, America has to rebuild its alliances. America has to rebuild its alliances in Europe. It's a crucial time on all kinds of fronts. But I do think that there's a wake up call. I think I'm optimistic. I hope. I hope.
How would you rank the importance of these elections, like in the span of your lifetime, let's say?
I would rank it the most important. Now, it's true that people always say that. So I realize that, you know, people have said that, you know, for a long time. But most everyone I know seems to feel the same way. I just turned 70. Yeah. So I've been through a lot of elections. And my, you know, my friends of my age, younger age, you know, older age, I all seem to agree that we've never felt this kind of importance. I was upset by many elections in the past, but I felt that our institutions were still strong. And I really think that because of the damage that Trump has done to our institutions, that's why if he got another 4 years, I don't know how America could, it would be much harder for America to recover from that. I think most people do feel that way. We've had plenty of presidents before. People have disagreed on policies, but we haven't really had a president before Trump who actually didn't seem to respect the institutions of America. And that's what makes us great, you know, if we are, and I hope we are. It's our institutions. And he has really been on the attack as far as that goes. He has wanted to run America like his own personal business, and that's not what this country is. So yeah, I definitely think this is the most important election. And I think I would feel strongly that the vast majority of Americans, I think, feel the same way.
Okay, then as a last question, let's look to not the most important election from that point of view, but to the next election. So in 4 years.
Maybe that's the most important election.
Maybe that will be the most important election, right? looking at it now, neither Trump, he will not be able to, nor Biden will run for the next election. So who do you think will be the next candidates, especially as you said that Biden would be a bridge to something new? And who would you want it to be?
Yeah, Yeah. Well, you know, my guess is that Biden won't run again. I mean, he'd be old. I mean, you know, frankly, even now, I mean, I wish we had a younger president. you know, I just turned 70 and, you know, I still work as a journalist and so forth, but I have much less energy than I did earlier. And the presidency is a pretty hard job. So I think it's better for a younger person. It's better for a younger person. I think the most logical candidate would be, you know, Kamala Harris, because she is the vice president. But, you know, would she be my favorite? I don't know. I have to see how she performs as vice president. Frankly, there were a lot of candidates on the Democratic side that I liked. I liked Pete Buttigieg. I thought he was an excellent one. I liked Elizabeth Warren. I think there are a lot of rising stars, so to speak, in the Democratic Party. And that makes me pleased. That makes me happy. I think there will be a lot of good people, you know, that are prospects in 4 years. Kamala will be the obvious one, unless she's, you know, not done well, you know, as in the vice presidency. But I'd be comfortable with her. I'm comfortable with her now. If, you know, if something should happen to Biden, I'm comfortable with her. Again, no one is perfect. Even Barack Obama, who was probably my favorite president of my lifetime. I didn't agree with everything, you know, that he did. There's always going to be that. But I think Biden is a bridge. I think he sees himself as a bridge, fortunately. You know, if he didn't, I don't think Trump sees himself as a bridge to anything except maybe his own children, you know. we'll see. We'll have to see, you know, in 4 years. But Kamala would be the obvious. We'll have to see how she does.
And on the Republican side, there will be a big orange hole.
Well, you know, there might be, because, I mean, you know, again, many Republicans have left the party. I mean, you know, I have somebody in my family, I'm not going to say who was a lifelong Republican and left the party over Donald Trump. I mean, look at the Lincoln Project. You know, I mean, a lot of people have left. So somebody could well emerge from the Republican Party who would be a strong candidate. I don't know. I think right now Trump is just so, everything is Trump, 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 Trump. I don't think anybody else can emerge. I mean, Trump himself doesn't want anyone to emerge, except maybe his daughter or, you know, Don Jr. or something. You know, he's not going to give any credit to anybody except an extension of himself. You know? But if Trump were gone, who knows what the Republican Party might come up with. I hope they do come up with good candidates. I like the two-party system, you know. I just don't like crazy people.
I mean, what I've asked myself recently is that does the Republican Party have to rethink itself or rethink its policies, considering the demographical changes in the United States? Mm-hmm. Because it would seem like most of the ideas won't have a majority in, let's say, 10 to 20 years, because there will be so many more Hispanics, for example, who are traditionally who traditionally vote Democrat.
Well, you know, when it comes to all of the now minority groups, they may not be minorities later on, African-Americans, Hispanics, even much smaller minority groups, religious Muslims, for example, so on. You can't ever say just exactly what they'll be, whether they'll be, you know, progressive, conservative, Democrat, whatever. I mean, within the Hispanic community, for example, there are a lot of conservatives in the Hispanic community. There's a real, I think it's going to be interesting, really interesting to see where the minorities who will soon be the majority in this country do in fact stand. We're finding that out because people are getting more and more involved, you know, as time goes on. I don't think we can really predict where the minority vote will be. We'll have to see. We'll have to see about that. But certainly, certainly we will not a majority white country, you know, I don't think, you know, in the future, which is perfectly fine with me. and I think acceptable, I hope, to the majority here too. That's what America's supposed to be. That's what America's supposed to be.
Great. Very beautiful final statement.
Final statement, yeah.
Well then, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you very much for, yeah, exactly.
Sure. Well, thank you for getting in touch with me. And I'm glad Tyler put us in touch. And I wish you the very best.
Soweit Beth Dufresne, der wir an dieser Stelle nochmal herzlich für das Interview danken möchten. Wie ihr euch denken könnt, sind wir natürlich nicht persönlich nach Connecticut an die Ostküste der USA geflogen, sondern haben das Gespräch über Zoom aufgezeichnet. Und wir müssen beide sagen, dass die Tonqualität überraschend überragend gewesen ist.
Ja, voll. Also falls ihr nicht dieser Meinung seid, schreibt es einfach unten in die Kommentare. Je tiefer, desto besser. Unser Schmäh sind so tief, dass wir jetzt gerade einiges rausgeschnitten haben. Und was dort in die Kommentare auch hingehört, einfach ja oder nein. Und zwar auf die Frage, ob wir eigene Social Media Seiten für unseren Podcast brauchen oder ob das so ausreicht. Und was haben wir sonst
noch? Genau, was haben wir sonst noch? Noch mehr. Also am Dienstag kommt pünktlich zur Wahl die dritte Folge. In der Wahlnacht werden wir außerdem eine besondere Folge aufnehmen. Im Zentrum steht natürlich die Wahl und unsere Wahlwette.
Ja, da kriege ich noch eine Kiste Bier von dir, gell? Das wird spannend.
Ja, ich fürchte es auch.
Ja, und bevor wir jetzt irgendwie bis zum Ende meandern, würde ich sagen, danke, dass ihr zugehört habt und bis bald.
Bis bald.